From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
My daughter was stopped from going to school by a handful of sectarian bigot racists. The beginning of the whole hate campaign against Catholic children going to school.
A Belfast mother says she must withdraw her daughter from the besieged Catholic Holy Cross school after the killing of a Catholic postal worker. Catholic and Protestant trade unions come together across Northern Ireland to say no to sectarian violence. The voice of Palestine radio is silenced as Israeli troops bomb it. And as U.S. troops meet resistance in Saudi Arabia, they set up a secret network of military bases in Central Asia. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. Unidentified gunmen on motorcycles fired indiscriminately at the American Center on a busy thoroughfare in Calcutta this morning, killing five Indian police officers, injuring 20 other people. Pools of blood, upturned chairs, and pieces of clothing lay scattered on the footpath outside the building, and bullet holes scarred the security wall. The Indian Interior Minister says a group which was involved in kidnapping an Indian businessman has claimed responsibility for the attack. He wouldn't name the group involved. He also claimed the group has links with Pakistan's main intelligence agency. The Red Cross accused the United States of violating the Geneva Conventions by releasing photographs of Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters held at Guantanamo Bay. The organization, whose inspection teams are interviewing detainees at the U.S. base in Cuba, says the conventions forbade exposing prisoners of war to public curiosity. The photograph showed men shackled and wearing masks and goggles. Red Cross, the European Union, the Netherlands, British legislators, and Amnesty International all say the men should be treated as prisoners of war rather than unlawful combatants, as the U.S. calls them. But British government officials defended the U.S., saying the three British subjects among the prisoners had no complaints about their treatments. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Los Angeles will hear a petition today backed by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, civil rights attorneys, journalism professors, and clergy who claim the detention of prisoners who have not been charged is illegal. The petition alleges the detainees are being held in violation of the U.S. Constitution and the Geneva Convention. It requests U.S. authorities produce the prisoners in a U.S. court, explain the reasons for their detention, and accord them due process guarantees. It also seeks to block any transfer of the detainees from the U.S. base in Cuba. An international donors conference in Tokyo, countries from around the world pledged more than $4.5 billion over 5 years for the rebuilding of Afghanistan. Iran alone pledged nearly $600 million. The U.S. contribution is low compared to the typical pattern of U.S. funding. Administration officials say because Washington has borne the bulk of the cost of the war, it expects other nations to play a greater role in rebuilding. The U.S. pledged some $300 million, but over a third of that money is to be taken from funds the U.S. had already pledged to help Afghan refugees. The U.S. says the refugees don't need the money. Meanwhile, the World Food Program says gunmen have hijacked a 40-ton aid shipment and beaten lorry drivers. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of refugees are expected to return to Afghanistan. Some 4 million Afghans are living in poverty in the foreign camps, and many others are displaced inside the country. As many as 40 Afghan asylum seekers, some of whom sewed their lips together last week to protest being held in the outback at one of Australia's largest and harshest detention camps, have collapsed from dehydration. This according to a statement smuggled out from the detainees and received in Sydney yesterday. The protesters say 500 detainees, mostly Afghans, have refused water and food despite temperatures of more than 105 degrees. Most of the unauthorized boat people travel to Australia from the Middle East via Indonesia. The government detains them until their visas are processed for months and sometimes years. The Australian Immigration Minister says the hunger strike will not influence Australia's immigration policy. Israeli troops shot and killed four members of the Islamic group Hamas in Nablus. The raid on Nablus came just as Israeli forces were pulling out of Tulkarm. The occupation there was the first time Israeli troops had occupied an entire town since partial Palestinian self-rule was granted in 1994. This news from the Democratic Republic of Congo military sources confirmed at least 13 people, including 7 soldiers, have been shot by the Rwandan-backed rebel group that controls the town of Goma. Large parts of the town were leveled by a huge lava flow. Some of those executed were looting. Meanwhile, on Monday, storage tanks in a gas station engulfed in hardening lava exploded, and as many as 100 people were killed. One man whose friend died in the explosion said, "We were just trying to get enough money to eat." In the latest in the Enron investigation, a former executive says Enron employees were shredding documents at the company's Houston offices as recently as last week. Her statement was the first indication documents were destroyed at Enron itself after reports of document shredding by accountants at Enron's auditor, Arthur Anderson. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. That's Bomb Track, Rage Against the Machine. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli commandos killed 4 people and arrested 9 other suspected Hamas militants during a raid early this morning on an alleged hideout in the West Bank town of Nablus. Earlier this morning, Israel moved to reoccupy part of the West Bank just hours after it seized control of the nearby town of Tulkarm, imposing a 24-hour curfew, sending troops door-to-door to hunt for militants and weapons. While Israeli forces have previously occupied positions in Palestinian-controlled territory, it's the first time in 16 months of conflict they've taken over an entire city. The raids in Tulkarm and Nablus follow 4 days of strikes, arrests, house demolitions by the Israeli army. On Saturday, Israeli troops entered the offices of Voice of Palestine to lay explosive charges. They blew up the 5-story building. Israel has said it's retaliating for a Palestinian attack that killed 6 people in northern Israel last Thursday when a lone Palestinian gunman walked into a crowded bar mitzvah celebration and opened fire. Yesterday, we grabbed a rare moment with the award-winning filmmaker Rashid Masharawi as he hoped to make his way out of the West Bank town of Ramallah into Jordan to begin a tour of his latest documentary, Live from Palestine. The film chronicles the world inside and outside the Voice of Palestine, the radio station that broadcasts the official positions of the Palestinian Authority. I asked Rashid Masharawi in Ramallah if he could tell us what was happening right then when we spoke to him yesterday afternoon.
Right now outside, there is clashes between the Palestinian and the Israeli tanks. They are bombing. But one of the areas, which is the most dangerous areas now, where it's my office, it's 300-400 meters from my home where I am staying now. I can see them from the window and hear the voice from home. Because tomorrow I am going through Jordan to Rotterdam Film Festival. I'm trying to reach my office just to take some video cassettes outside. So I'm in contact all the time with the ambulances, the 101, to if they have 10, 15 minutes of quiet just to get in, to get my cassettes out of the office. Actually, when you called me the first time, I thought this is the ambulance driver. And I was not ready to talk with nobody, but because you call from far away, then we say for sure we will talk. you know, every 3-4 hours we are in different situation. Now this is what's going on here.
So you're saying you're trying to get the ambulance and the ambulance driver to take your video cassettes out?
I am out of the ambulances because they can be there. They can watch the area. I can know if I can get in my office. They can call me to tell me if it's possible to get in my office. And since 1 o'clock in the morning, noon, until now, it's not possible. And still I have hope. Because maybe I thought, because it's raining outside also, and it's very cold, maybe they will feel cold, and the weather maybe they will make them get back a little bit. But it did not look like this. The last 3 days, they come in the night, and they go back in the morning. But today they start to shoot when we were in the office, 6 people working there. So we close everything and we run out and we take some things because we afraid if they will get in, they will destroy inside our... we have some light and sound equipment and editing and things like that.
So tell us about the Voice of Palestine, Palestinian radio. What happened to it exactly?
Actually, day before yesterday, this was one of the really sad days also for the people in Ramallah here, and especially for me, because I spend time with in this building with those people who work there. I spend 3 months in this building by filming the programs and the news and the people's life, and I film at home of some people, and my film was not really about bombing. My film was more about those people who work there, about the Voice of Palestine. This is the official radio for related to the Palestinian Authority. During the film, many times we were in danger because this building was a target, and we expected these things. When I was filming the film about the radio, every night I was waiting until the morning just to wake up and to go there, because I was in very nice atmosphere with some people. They are not so professional and they are not really media makers. They work with old equipment. Everybody think what he is doing, it's some art, or he have his own personal career, or he is supporting the situation or something. And those people, same people that I met 2 days ago in the radio, everybody trying to save small things, if it exists something that he can take home out of this building.
Again, we're speaking with Rashid Mashrawi, who is in Ramallah. He is the director of the documentary Here's the Voice of Palestine, about Palestinian radio, which was bombed on Saturday by the Israeli Defense Forces. Can you explain just what happened on Saturday? What physically happened?
I mean, the Israeli army, they went in at night. They get into the building. They get inside each single room and single studio and equipments, and they put bombs and dynamite, and they bomb it. They just bomb it. I was sleeping at home, and it's not far from my home also, because Ramallah, it's very, very close. I mean, if my office 500 meters this direction, the radio 400 meters other direction. And I hear the voice, but I was not expecting this will be the radio, because all the time you hear voices here at night. And
was anyone hurt?
Unfortunately, this was the radio.
And was anyone physically hurt?
No, because they did not bomb it from a plane or from tanks. Physically, they get inside the radio, inside the place. They
dynamited it from the inside.
Yeah, it's like operation for each single room. And, it's difficult. It's very difficult to describe it, because the radio, what the Israeli army thought it is, what they bomb, they didn't know nothing here. I mean, they just bomb it without knowing. I mean, we talk about two different radios. They talk about the radio of the Voice of Palestine related to Palestinian Authority, let's bomb it and things like that. But my radio, it's small radio with a small group in a small neighborhood. It's warm atmosphere and people trying to do things in this situation. I don't know.
This is not the first time that they have bombed the Voice of Palestine, is that right? Or this time they dynamited it, but the last time?
Yeah, they bombed it twice before, but it was not really the building. It was the transmitters, the antennas. It was around the building of the radio itself. It was more just to destroy things. But what was day before yesterday? I film and I talk with people there. And they destroy many things inside people, you know, which is more danger than antennas and stones and machines and equipment.
Let me ask, the last time this happened, Israeli documentary filmmakers screened your film, Here is the Voice of Palestine, at the Tel Aviv Cinematheque, at the Tel Aviv Film Festival. What was the response of that?
You know, in Israel, always same groups, same people who is ready to come to saw those kind of films, they come. Any occasion and any activity, you will reach the same 200-300 of people who come and who are interesting to be there and to see this kind of works. Sometimes I didn't know. Sometimes I think, yes, we should show the films there to let the people to know. And sometimes I think it also help the Israelis to feel better that they can show those films there, but they can do nothing. They cannot help the situation.
Were you there?
No, I was not able to go there because nobody gave me a permission. Yesterday, the film was broadcast in screening in the Jerusalem Cinematheque. I was not there, and I am 10 minutes by car far from there.
What do you mean, permission?
Permission, it means to go from Ramallah to Jerusalem. I need permission from Israel, and the cinematic try 3 weeks with all the Israeli official offices who related to this kind of things, and they didn't succeed to give me permission for one night to go there.
Again, we're talking to Rashid Mashrawi, a filmmaker who did his film on Palestinian radio. The way AP puts the dynamiting of Palestinian radio is by saying they dealt the Israeli forces dealt another retaliatory blow to Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority. Can you explain what the position of Palestinian radio is, what its role is, how it is or is not connected to Yasser Arafat?
You know, it is connected to Yasser Arafat because this is related to the Palestinian Authority and this is the voice of Palestine. And it should also serve the Palestinian needs, even in the political situation, politically or economically or in the society. Or it is related to the it's official radio and official channel. But the problem is the Israeli occupation. When they bomb something here in Ramallah, or they kill people, which has happened, as you know, every day. And the radio made the news and show those things from our direction, because they cannot, only the Palestinian or other foreign media can be in those locations and describe what's happened. They consider it propaganda, but it means if they will stop bombing us or stopping killing people here, there is no need also to show those films, those things in the Palestinian television or to talk about them in the Palestinian radio. What's danger happening here? Israel trying to turn the area that we are like two states fighting with two armies, you know. But it's not like that in reality. We are under the Israeli occupation. and they can do whatever they want day and night because they have also the sky, you know, and they have the power and they have the army and they have the tanks and they have everything. The world cannot understand, and they cannot understand that this occupation cannot continue. If they will stop this occupation, stop those settlements, we have no problems. You know, we have really no problems with them. And we agree to survive in small part of Palestine and all those things. But I mean, they don't want to agree that all our problem here, the Israeli occupation, if they will get out of here, it will not be bombing. It will not even be bombing in Israel, not here. It will solve all the problems. But what we have here, we have Sharon, who tried to turn all the area only to war because he did not have any political aspect, any political vision, any material to negotiate. He have nothing to give the Palestinians, you know. And we cannot play Sharon's way because Sharon's way is war. We are not good in war because we cannot make war because we are the weak part in this game. But he, out of the big Israeli media machine in Israel and all over the world, they succeed to show the people here as a terrorist, the people who really trying to survive, you know, trying to protect them on self personally, or them on houses. This mean you can imagine that for me to film a film 3 days ago, I should hide small light projectors from one area to other area, one by one, secretly, just to make a film which is not related directly to what they are doing. Just a person trying to make a film and try to move with a small crew, 10 people, with some equipment from one place to other. I cannot make it in my neighborhood. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Rashid Masharawi, award-winning filmmaker, whose latest documentary is Live from Palestine, a film that chronicles the world inside and outside the Voice of Palestine, the radio station the U.S. Army dynamited this past weekend in Ramallah on the West Bank. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Northern Ireland, and then we'll look at the secret ring of U.S. military bases around Afghanistan. Stay with us.
And as I walk on through troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes, sometimes. Where are the strong? And who are the trusting? And where is the harmony, sweet harmony now? 'Cause each time I feel it slipping away, just makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Nick Lowe, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, and you can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear about the latest contacts of our guests, as well as gather background information on the different subjects that we cover on the program. Well, in this past month, a 20-year-old Catholic postal worker was murdered outside Belfast, and tensions are high in Catholic North Belfast. The murder was claimed by a branch of the Loyalist paramilitary force known as the Ulster Defence Association and was a major blow to the Northern Irish peace process. Many believe Northern Ireland had entered a new era in its 30 years of conflict after the IRA agreed to begin disarmament shortly after the September 11th attacks. But last week, riots flared in Catholic and Protestant enclaves in Belfast and other Northern Irish towns. Crowds threw petrol bombs stones, blast bombs, attack police. Since the murder, postal workers and teachers in Catholic schools across Northern Ireland have suffered a series of death threats, prompting a major security operation to protect teachers and pupils at Belfast schools. Yesterday morning, a Protestant boys' school was evacuated after a bomb threat. The renewed violence and threats come after months of loyalist protests outside the Catholic Holy Cross Girls Elementary School, which is just outside Belfast. Protests in the increasingly Catholic neighborhood of the school flared several months ago and have continued to terrorize students and parents entering and leaving the school with a hail of abuse, scalding tea, urine-filled balloons. After a pipe bomb exploded at the school, riots broke out at night. Today we go to Belfast and are joined by Anne Tanney. She's the principal of the school, and also by Angie Boyle. Her 10-year-old daughter, Helen, is a student at Holy Cross. And last week, Angie Boyle decided to withdraw her daughter from the school. Angie Boyle, welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Why have you decided to pull Helen out?
I decided during Christmas, you know, that it would be a good idea that she didn't go through any more problems, you know, with terrorist attacks on children. It's incredible. I felt that I had legitimately pursued every other avenue, you know, for some sort of resolution to be in place, at, you know, over the Christmas period. And having gone back and just seeing how, you know, the residents had come out again, they weren't actually calling it to protest, but they were actually there just seriously to intimidate people with their children. It was quite incredible, and just thought, enough is enough. You know, nobody seems to care. It's a really desperate, desperate feeling. And I just thought, for Helen's sake, you know, it would probably be the best thing to do. Now, she's not really settling into her new school, which she started last Thursday. And what the difficulty is, you know, that you have to weigh the balance of the real threat that you have of maybe something erupting up at the school again, and the fact that she's in a new school, she might be finding it difficult to settle in, but it's really, you know, a balance. So you have to think, it's so difficult to even describe, that you have had to take this type of action because of sectarian, bigoted racists who were never, you know, legally pursued. And really, that's, you know.
We're also joined on the phone by Anne Tanney, principal of the Catholic Holy Cross Girls Elementary School. Can you describe the origins of these latest threats and what it's like to be principal there?
Well, it's hard to know where the origins have actually come from. The latest threats to Catholic teachers were from a Protestant paramilitary organization. At least they said it was from a Protestant paramilitary organization. And I'm glad to say that those threats have now been lifted. It is very difficult here because we did have, as you saw, I'm sure, in the news, all the trouble about getting the children to school and back from school in September. And that continued for 3 months. And then coming up to Christmas, the protest was suspended. And we thought that at last we were going to get back to normal. And we had a lovely Christmas. And the children were helped by all the cards and letters and gifts which we received from all over the world, especially from Canada and from the US. We had more than 20,000 Christmas cards. So we started the new year with great optimism, thinking that things were going to change. But then we had another incident in the new year, and we again weren't able to get some of the children out of school, and then we had the threats for Catholic teachers. So again this week, we are trying to get back to normal, really.
We're also joined by two school teachers on the line who helped organize a major trade union rally last Friday in protest of the recent outbreaks of sectarian violence. The Irish Congress of Trade Unions joined with teachers and hospital unions to call for a half-day work stoppage to end the riots. Close to 50,000 people came out for the demonstration in the pouring rain on Friday in central Belfast and in towns across Northern Ireland. Our guests are John Price, a school teacher at the Catholic School in Belfast, member of Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and Mark Hewitt, school teacher at a Protestant school. Mark Hewitt, let's begin with you. The climate in your school and how you think this sectarian violence will end.
I would say the climate in my school is fairly low-key. I mean, paradoxically, you look at the situation on the TV and you look at Northern Ireland, I can understand, you know, seeing the riots and that. But I teach in a school in East Belfast, and it's about 5 miles, 6 or 7 miles away from, you know, North Belfast, and you wouldn't believe that you'd be in the same city. That doesn't mean to say that there are discussions. There aren't discussions that happen in the school all the time. There is. You know, talking about sectarianism and so on. And I think for a lot of people at this school, you know, it was building up to a crescendo in terms of the violence. And then with the death threats issued against Catholic, you know, our Catholic counterparts, and then finally the shooting of a postal worker, you know, carrying out his job, you know, people made the quick connection that could have been us, and therefore we felt we had to do something about it. And that pressure calling for a half-day strike, a half-day work stoppage, actually came from, you know, teachers from our union really pushing all the unions to do something about it. And I think, you know, the response has actually been wonderful, that response, and managed to get the death threat lifted. And that's important as well.
John Price, explain what it's like at your school. Which Catholic school do you teach at?
The largest single-sex school in Europe, St. Louis's Comprehensive College on the Falls Road in Belfast.
And describe how you came together with Protestant school teachers, what the Irish Congress of Trade Unions is.
Okay. Well, I belong to the NASUWT, that's the National Association of Schoolmasters Union of Women Teachers, which is the largest teachers union within Northern Ireland. And Mark, who teaches in a Protestant school, we decided that nothing was being done in relation to the teaching profession taking a stand, which was long overdue, against sectarianism. And in that vacuum, obviously, sectarianism thrives and so on. So we assembled a petition and called upon the NASUWT to stage a demonstration at the City Hall in Belfast before Christmas in support of the sectarian attacks, the pipe bomb attacks, the excretia being hurled at those children, the daily abuse, the urine-filled balloons, as you rightly reported earlier in your description of those sectarian attacks. You know, if this was a Muslim school in London, there would be a whole hue and cry. There would be teachers would be down in tools, but nothing was being done here. And we were very gratified, and immediately the teachers from my school en masse signed the petition, and the teachers, both Protestant and Catholic teachers, were united in this, and we called upon the NASUWT to take action and do this. But they didn't do it. That was the problem. They didn't. At the Belfast Executive decided at the AGM not to do that, that it would foment further problems and so on. And had they have done that, we may not have had the death of Mr. McColgan and the other, you know, the postal worker who was killed. It took 8 teachers' cars to be damaged and teachers to be threatened themselves before the teachers' unions took action here. They didn't take action, and this is demonstrably the case, they didn't take action on behalf of children. So in loco parentis, in place of the parent, that golden principle by which we abide as teachers, that went out the window, and it was too little too late. Certainly everybody was on board at the wonderfully attended rally on where people stood shoulder to shoulder in the anti-sectarian demonstration at the City Hall. And our own staff walked in solidarity with hospital workers from the Royal Victoria Hospital. It was a wonderful sight to behold. The trade union movement is the way to oppose sectarianism. And in appalling weather conditions, people were united, and they realized the potential and the strength that we have to do that.
I wanted to turn to Anne Tanney, principal of Catholic Holy Cross Girls Elementary School. What difference did the strike, the protest on Friday, make, and what do you think needs to be done right now?
Well, I think we were very pleased that teachers had come out and that all workers had come out against sectarianism. We were very, very sad when this young man, a young postal worker, was murdered on last Saturday morning. And I think that the people in Northern Ireland generally felt that this was enough, really. We have had enough of the sectarianism, that we have to move together and we have to work together for the future. We had been working very hard in our school at cross-community contact, because this is a Catholic school in a Protestant area, And over the years, we had built up very good relationships with the school beside us here, the Protestant school. All our children had worked with them from primary 1 to primary 7. That is, from the 4-year-olds to the 11-year-olds had all worked together. And we had made a very definite effort to open the hand of friendship to our neighbours. So we are very disappointed, and it is very sad that we have become a focus for such hatred and such sectarianism and such violence. And I think what we have to do now is try to change that so we become a focus for peace and reconciliation and love. And love in the sense of showing our neighbours that we really wish them well, that we don't wish them harm. How we're going to do that is going to be very difficult because we are so hurt and there has been so much hurt here that we have to work very slowly at that. But we will be trying to do that in the future.
Again, Aunt Tanny is the principal of Catholic Holy Cross Girls Elementary School. What difference could people make here in the United States for the situation that you face in Belfast?
Well, I think we have already received a great deal of support and kindness and prayers from people in the United States, and we're very grateful for that. I think that certainly has renewed our faith in human nature. And one of the things which we have noticed is that lots and lots of children have been writing to us and telling us that they're thinking about us and they're praying for us. And I think really all of those prayers must have some good result. I think that in general terms, the politicians in Northern Ireland have to realise that everyone should now be working against sectarianism. That if there has to be progress, it has to be political progress. And if people want change, that they must work politically for change and socially for change. And that children should never be involved in disputes where there are adult problems and society problems, and that adults should deal with those.
Yesterday, Sinn Féin leaders went to the British Parliament, went to Parliament for the first time. What is the significance of this? Let me ask you, Angie Boyle, mother of Helen, who you withdrew from the Holy Cross School.
Sorry, Amy, would you repeat the question, please? I was just slightly distracted. There's fireworks going off.
The question of Sinn Féin leaders going to Parliament yesterday.
Well, I think that it's progress for them politically. However, you know, I don't think it's me to just sit and discuss my politics personally. I don't think would probably be right. But I mean, I think for Sinn Féin as a party to go to the Houses of Commons and take office, you know, and then, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy within Sinn Féin. You know, they won't sit on the police board, different things, you know, that seem hypocritical. They won't sit in police boards, yet they'll go in and meet with the police on a daily basis on a community level. I mean, it all just seems slightly, you know, mixed up in the way they're approaching their own politics and trying to develop it, you know. So, I mean, they're saying on the one hand, we'll take a place in our offices and we'll take the paycheck, but on the other hand, we're not going to ever have an MP who takes his place in the House. It's all quite contradictory, isn't it?
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Angie Boyle, mother of Helen, 10-year-old, who she withdrew from the Holy Cross School after threats against the children. And Tanny, principal of the Catholic Holy Cross Girls Elementary School. And two school teachers, one from a Protestant school in Belfast, Mark Hewitt and John Price of the Catholic school in Belfast, member of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions that went out on strike this past Friday. 50,000 people marched against the sectarian violence. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, and you can email us, by the way, at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. By the way, tomorrow on the program, we'll be speaking with Philip Jones Griffith. He is author of Vietnam, Inc., first published in 1971, crucial in changing public attitudes in the United States, turning the tide of opinion and ultimately helping to put an end to the Vietnam War. His classic account of the war was the outcome of 3 years reporting and is one of the most detailed surveys of any conflict, showing the true horrors of war, as well as a study of Vietnamese rural life. We're going to talk about the dehumanizing power of the modern war machine. And we're going to be joined by Philip Jones Griffith, the photographer and journalist in our studio. You are listening to The Exception to the Rulers, Democracy Now!, back in a minute.
What we gonna do, what we really gonna do when the world that we know goes away in the face of war? What are we fighting for? Gotta really know, gotta really, really know that the only way to fly is to not be afraid to die. Cause your protection is in the light. What we gonna do, what we really gonna do when the world that we know goes away in the face of war? What are we fighting for? Gotta really know, gotta really, really know that the only way to fly is to not be afraid to die. Cause your protection is in the light. Sing with us. War! What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Say it again. War! What is
You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. What we gonna do? Ayanna Gregory and Yvette Benjamin. By the way, if you have music that you'd like to send it to us, we often play the musical compositions of listeners or suggestions that they have. You can send us your CDs at the firehouse where we're broadcasting from in Chinatown. It was in the evacuation zone after September 11th, and it remains our home, Downtown Community Television. You can write to us at Downtown Community Television, or DCTV, 87 Lafayette Street, New York, New York, 1013. That's DCTV, 87 Lafayette Street, New York, New York, 1013. Or you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Persian Gulf War may have ended, but the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia has not. Recent news reports suggest that Saudi Arabia's rulers may soon ask the U.S. to pack up its troops and withdraw from their soil. While President-elect Bush, the Secretary of State General Powell, and the Secretary of War Rumsfeld have all denied these reports, they come at a time when U.S.-Saudi relations have reached a new and precarious low. The United States has maintained a presence in Saudi Arabia ever since the Gulf War, when both countries feared an Iraqi invasion of the oil-rich kingdom. While the Saudis were never at ease with the arrangement, they tolerated the U.S. out of a sense of expediency and the belief that the Americans would leave as soon as the U.S. bombing ended. When U.S. troops remained, however, Saudi resentment rose, culminating in the bombing of the Khobar Towers in 1996. 19 American soldiers died in the attack. Hundreds more were wounded. But while the connection between Saudi anger and U.S. troops has been made amply clear, the United States has not left the country. It merely struck a lower profile. As columnist Bill Arkin wrote in a rare and groundbreaking Los Angeles Times article, quote, "Behind a veil of secret agreements, the United States is creating a ring of new and expanded military bases that encircle Afghanistan. While these bases make it easier for the United States to project its power, they may also increase prospects for renewed terrorist attacks on Americans. The new buildup is occurring with almost no public discussion." Well, I spoke with Bill Arkin a few days ago and asked him to describe what he's seeing now, the developments that are getting so little attention in the United States.
Well, since the very beginning of Operation Enduring Freedom, there has been an effort on the part of the Pentagon to suppress news and information about exactly where aircraft and military forces are operating from, as well as to even cover the tracks of American officials as they make their way through the Middle East and through the former Soviet states in their various diplomatic and exchange visits. So it's really been quite stunning to me that the news is filled with reserve units and active duty units from the United States going over to base X or undisclosed locations, and that this has really been acceptable to both the media and the Congress and the American public. I think that there is a web of new bases, agreements, covert relationships, and potential dangers for the United States that should be discussed openly, because in this particular case, the only people who are being kept in the dark about the presence of American forces are the American people.
And what do you think the dangers are of these new bases?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to dismiss justifications for how the Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden networks thought about their attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. It's easy just to say this is irrational and this is, you know, baseless and this is just hatred against America. And if one frames the problem as one that is merely about the question of the Arab-Israeli conflict or some Islamic versus non-Islamic battle, then I think one also ignores some of the actual stimuli which has grown up in the 1990s that I believe has bred both the terrorism and the style of terrorism. And that is to say that the Gulf War in 1991 reached an inconclusive end. We didn't topple Saddam Hussein. And it was very clear at the end of the Gulf War as well that Iraq had a far greater arsenal of weapons of mass destruction than U.S. intelligence had ever anticipated or knew. And so U.S. forces never went home. They never left Saudi Arabia. They never left Kuwait. They never left the Gulf states. And this was really a departure from the entire history of American military activity in this part of the world. If one remembers August 1990, it took Secretary of Defense Cheney and a high-level delegation to go and kiss the ring of King Faisal in Saudi Arabia to even get permission for U.S. forces to go in there to protect that country against Iraq. So the assumption was we would leave. Saudis have tolerated the American presence as long as the United States didn't speak about them. And it's been described to me that U.S. soldiers and airmen who live in Saudi Arabia live in essentially a velvet prison, which is to say that the Saudis have built these magnificent facilities for them, but they're essentially condemned to living on their bases. And I think that the roots of Osama bin Laden's hatred of the United States comes to some degree from the presence of these forces in Saudi Arabia. He constantly refers to the defilement of the holy places, that is Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia, by U.S. forces and their presence in the region. And so to merely think that we have geopolitical pins on the map, and not at the same time that those that inconclusive ending of the Gulf War and our continued presence in this part of the world doesn't by itself provide its own stimuli, I think is foolish. And I think now there is greater and greater evidence that, in fact, the attacks on the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in 1996, the attacks on the USS Cole in 1999, were clearly directed at U.S. military targets in that part of the world because of a growing presence of the U.S. military in the area, and now justified by military operations in Afghanistan, this huge new network has been established with new bases in Uzbekistan, in Tajikistan, in Kyrgyzstan, in Pakistan, as well as increased military presence in places like Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and even Saudi Arabia, where quietly the United States has built up even more capabilities.
We're talking to military analyst Bill Arkin, who did an expose on the U.S. air bases that are now ringing Afghanistan, presence in 9 countries. You use the example of Master Sergeant Evander Earl Andrews, the first U.S. casualty of what the military calls Operation Enduring Freedom, the bombing of Afghanistan. Can you talk about what his case illustrates?
Well, for this Master Sergeant who was killed in a forklift construction accident while building and improving the facilities at an air base, when he initially died, the Pentagon stated that he was serving at an undisclosed location and had been airlifted from that location to Turkey to go to a hospital. It was sort of just the story was reported because it was obviously an important story and human interest that someone died, but no one really pursued the question of where was this guy, and it turns out that he was working on construction of an improvement of the facilities at Al Ubaid in Qatar, one of the Gulf states. A huge new facility that the United States had begun constructing in April 2000, 15,000-foot runway, enormous billion-dollar facilities to accommodate as many as 120 airplanes. I think that's larger than the entire size of the Qatar Air Force. And this had quietly been going on for a year and a half prior to the beginning of bombing in October. There was little discussion of it in the Congress and military construction hearings. There was no discussion of it at all. And U.S. forces were being sent to this base and operate from this base now as part of the air war without any acknowledgement of their presence. Now, again, Qatar is probably, as most people have become aware because of the existence of Al Jazeera, one of the more liberal states in the region.
And some people mispronounce it as Qatar, but just to let people know, Q-A-T-A-R is what Bill Arkin is talking
right.
about.
Right. It's called Qatar. And the reality is that there's no real justification for the presence to be secret. But I think that the way diplomats and Pentagon political military officers see it is, you know, once you reveal the presence in one place, then people will ask for information about the presence in other places, and then ultimately you have to sort of acknowledge the ultimate prize, which is the presence of U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia in a wide variety of military bases throughout the country, where the Saudis impose a variety of constraints on U.S. operations. We're not allowed to bomb Iraq from Saudi bases, as an example. Surveillance planes can operate from Saudi bases. Aerial refueling planes can operate from Saudi bases. Airlift can operate from Saudi bases. But if a bomb drops in Iraq, it has to be a bomber that comes from an aircraft carrier or from Kuwait or Bahrain or some other place. That's the Saudi restriction. So in order to sort of cover up this Saudi fig leaf, if you will, the United States just doesn't discuss operations at all. And so the reason why then, therefore, we can't know about the presence of U.S. forces in Qatar or the UAE or in Oman, places that seem to be, on the surface at least, more comfortable with an American military presence, is to cover the presence in Saudi Arabia, which is far more sensitive.
Bill Arkin, we have Prothap Chatterjee on the line with us from Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Democracy Now! Correspondent. As Bill Arkin describes this ring of bases that are being established around Afghanistan in 9 different countries, what evidence is there in Uzbekistan to the general public, Prothap?
Not a lot to the general public. And just to give people a quick geographical sketch of where I am and what it is that's happening here, is Afghanistan is bordered to the north by 3 countries, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. To the west is Turkmenistan, and it's governed by Niyazov, who is a megalomaniac, and at the very least in, by way of not somebody the U.S. necessarily wants to ally themselves with. And on the east is Tajikistan, which is, you know, in a state of political chaos, both countries of which have, you know, the infrastructure is probably not as good as where I am right now in the center in Uzbekistan. And so here we have one base, and then to the north of Tajikistan, not bordering Afghanistan, in Kyrgyzstan, there's another base, two major bases being constructed. And right now there's 1,000 troops. They've been here actually for quite a while in Uzbekistan, in Khanabad, whereas in Kyrgyzstan there's just about 300 troops, and they're expecting as many as 3,000 in the next several months once that it becomes operational. But if you... people know about it, people have heard about it, but the Americans are keeping a low profile here. The reason they are more welcome here is because the government is really cracking down on anybody in this country that has any link to anything that's outside of state Islam. And so it's friendly to the Americans, but at the same time, the U.S. feels fairly confident out here that there are very few open extremists. So the U.S. feels a lot safer here, and it's because there are 7,000 political prisoners, you know, who are in jail for as many as 13 years for handing out leaflets from groups like Hizbullah Tahrir out here. So that's where we are, and this is where a lot of the operations are taking place in terms of where the U.S. is trying to... establish a base for future operations in Afghanistan.
That was Prothap Chatterjee speaking to us from Tashkent, Uzbekistan, and also Bill Arkin, who did the groundbreaking piece in the Los Angeles Times for the first time exposing this ring of U.S. military bases, up to 13 new bases around Afghanistan. And that does it for today's program. On Friday, the singer and songwriter Dara Williams will be joining us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. By the way, stay tuned in the coming weeks for our coverage of the Porto Alegre World Social Summit that's going to be taking place in Brazil. Deepa Fernandez and Chris Abrams will be down covering that. And here in New York, the World Economic Forum will be covering that as well. You can send us mail, snail mail, by writing to Democracy Now!, DCTV, 87 Lafayette Street, New York, New York, 1013. That's Democracy Now! At DCTV, 87 Lafayette Street, New York, New York, 1013. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We are broadcasting from Downtown Community Television. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Also, special thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We thank Free Speech TV as we broadcast on DirecTV, channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel, broadcasting on public access stations around the country, as well as community radio stations, KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, KPFK in Los Angeles, hoping soon to be on at 9 o'clock as well, KPFT in Houston, WPFW in Washington, and WBAI here at home. We are no longer in exile. We are Democracy Now!, and we're back. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Number one, and it's time.